All right. So the next question we're going to deal with is the Bible true? We're going to be testing for textual integrity. What we want is an eyewitness record of the life of Jesus, demonstrating what have we discovered so far? That clearly human beings end, and life is meaningless if there is no God or creator. Nothing exists outside of the universe. Secondly, the fingerprints of God in nature. Christianity is unique in that it's the only faith that claims that we can know that God exists because God entered into human history. And now we're going to see if whether or not we have a historical record that can document or has documented and been preserved of the events that demonstrate whether this actually took place or not. Okay? Now, there's a lot of skepticism about faith and about Jesus. In fact, I would say there's probably no historical figure that has been more scrutinized, more studied than anything else in the history of the science. people of faith and people of not faith have come out as skeptics, like Bart Ehrman, who apparently was raised in a Christian home and was a believer at one time, and he's a scholar and he's a professor and thinks that the Bible is just a false idol. Of course, we have popular works like the Da Vinci Code. Everything our fathers taught us about Christ is wrong. I remember the first time a family member said, have you seen the movie? Have you read the book? Oh my goodness, the Da Vinci Code proves it all. Everything we believed about Jesus was wrong. And so what they would have us believe is that the Christ of faith, whom we sing to, whom we pray in the name of, whom we believe is divine and came in real history, claimed to be God, performed many miracles, was executed because of his claim, and then genuinely proved the final proof for his claim by coming back from the dead. That is the Christ of faith. Separate from that person is the Christ of history. And they are two different people. The Christ of faith is not the Christ of history. The Christ of history was a real sage or prophet or a revolutionary who lived in the first century, who stood up against a tyrannical government and had a revolutionary way of thinking about Jewish life. And that's it. Everything else was embellished 200 years later, you know, way after the fact, after all the eyewitnesses died, all the stories about who Christ really is were sort of embellished over time, and Jesus was transformed from the Christ of history, or I should say the Jesus of history, to the Christ of faith. Because Christ is a title. It's not like it was his last name. You know, people didn't go around going, hey, Mr. Christ, could I ask you a question? It was a title, meaning Jesus of Nazareth, the Messiah, the promised one. So this, maybe some people believed he was the Messiah, but in terms of him being divine, that was sort of made up years and years later in order to control people, or wishful thinking or whatever it might be, whatever reasons people come up with religions. And so the idea that Jesus claimed to be God, obviously when we look at this is something that C.S. Lewis put together in his Lord, Liar, Lunatic. And I've kind of changed some of the terms around, but if Jesus genuinely claimed to be God, or even if we just made up the fact that Jesus claimed to be God, there's really only two options. He either is or he isn't the God that came out of transcendent eternity and entered into the universe, into our space and time. He stepped out of heaven and he visited planet Earth. He either is or he isn't. Now, if he isn't, we only have two real options, and that is that he knew it or he didn't know it. Now, if he isn't God and his claim is false and he knew it, then that would make him a liar, a magician, a deceiver, a trickster. Many of my colleagues who are atheists in the entertainment field of the art of illusion believe just that, and it's a growing belief. In fact, my mentor Andre Cole recently shared that he's running into more and more skeptics, people at atheist conventions that say, because of the evidence that I'm going to show you now, that really, you can't say that the Jesus of faith was transformed hundreds of years later. The manuscript evidence just says otherwise, and we'll cover that in a minute. Jesus, he must have said these things. He must have done things that convinced everyone around him. The only explanation is that he was a magician. Or he didn't know that he wasn't God. He claimed it. He isn't. His claim is false, but he didn't know it, and he was crazy. And we'll very briefly cover those two things, but the one I want to cover now is that the third option, which is something that's overlooked oftentimes, and that is that the reason it's hard to believe that Jesus was a magician, because the miracles are so fantastical, no magician could ever do these things, even using trickery and illusions and technology. When you look at whether or not Jesus was a maniac, if you were to actually live the way he lived and the way he taught, you'd have optimal mental health. In fact, there was a book called Ghost God, Jesus, Ghost God or Guru. It was written by a historian and a psychologist, and he analyzed the sayings of Jesus, the life of Jesus, the habits of Jesus, and tried to look for signals of whether he was mentally unstable. And again, right out of the book, if you were to live the way Jesus actually taught, you would have optimal mental health. So there was no clues that Jesus was crazy. And as a magician, there was no, and I'll talk a little bit about that more in a moment, but there was no clues that he was actually a magician. So the only real other explanation is that the miracle stories, the divinity stories, these were all myths made up towards the late second century and onward. So again, the Jesus of history is separate from the Jesus of faith. Now, when we look at whether or not we want to have a record to determine which one's right, which one is the correct Jesus, we need, and first of all, an eyewitness account. I don't want stories that were written hundreds of years later. We'll maybe briefly cover this when we talk about Islam, but you'll notice that the picture of the Jesus of Islam is very different than the picture of Jesus in the Gospels. And the Jesus of Islam did not die on the cross and is not divine. He is just a prophet. And there's other caricatures that are very different. But consider that this, the Quran, which these sayings come from, was written when? In the 7th century. Now, what would I use? Would I use something that was written in the 2nd century? Or would I choose something that was written about Jesus as a historical figure in the 7th century? Which one would have more credibility? Obviously, the ones that are written in the 2nd century. Now, but better yet would be if I could find something that was an eyewitness account, meaning contemporaries of Jesus, people who actually lived with him, walked with him, talked with him. I want to hear what they said about Jesus. So does such an eyewitness account exist? And has that account been transmitted over time with integrity? And thirdly, does this record have the hallmarks of historicity, or does it have the hallmarks of fables and myths, like many of the other divine fable stories of other cultures in ancient history? So that's the kinds of things that we're going to be looking for. And the clues that we'll be using to give us the answers will first be manuscript discoveries and, of course, archaeological discoveries. So we're going to be talking about manuscripts and archaeology. Sounds exciting, huh? You guys stoked? Manuscripts and archaeology. What is that? So I have here, as an example, a piece of ancient literature. This was written, it's on the screen so you can cheat. This was written in 50 BC. Isn't it an amazing condition? I mean, I've never seen something written that long ago with such great print quality, binding. You would think the paper would be a little more yellow after this much time. No, this isn't it. What is this? If this is not that, what is this? A copy. Now, how do you suspect this happened? Now, you can imagine, okay, so Caesar decides he wants to record his mighty conquests. and he has his scribes together, and they start writing these conquests, and then he finishes it, and he puts it on display in his palace or wherever, and one of his closest friends and sees it and goes, "Whoa, what is that?" "It's my last work, everything that I've done, my conquests, the battles, the drama, all of it. Oh, can I see it?" "Yes, you can see it." "Can I borrow it?" "No." "But I would love to read it and just have it." "Can't." "Can I make a copy?" "Okay, I'll let you make a copy." So they take it to Kinko's and make copies. And that's how we have it today. Right? Darn, I wish Kinko's existed in the first century BC. But it didn't. There was no Kinko's. There might have been a guy named Kinko, but I don't know that. And so here's what they did. Their form of Kinko's back then was a guy like that. A scribe. And what he would do is he would take Caesar's Gallic Wars and he would copy it on a new parchment, whatever they use, papyrus, skins, leaves, and he would make a new copy. Now, what could possibly happen when he makes that copy? Is it possible he could make a mistake? Now, these guys were really good at making copies. But, so they made a lot less mistakes than you and I would if we were copying someone's letter, something like that. These are professional copyists. So they were really good at not making mistakes. And they were really good at going back and correcting their mistakes. But nevertheless, mistakes could be made. And so he finishes his copy and his friend has it. Now, somebody else notices that this guy has the copy of it, and they want a copy, but they don't know Julius. So what do they need to do? They're not going to go and ask him. They ask the friend, "Hey, can I get a copy?" I suppose it wouldn't be that problem. Well, they can't go to the really expensive scribes that Caesar had access to, so they have to go to a cheaper guy. He might make more mistakes. And they make a copy of the copy. They make a copy of the copy, and this goes on endless. Till we have this. Because of those scribes, I am told, on the highest scholarship available to our minds of our last 150 years, that this is what he wrote. Now, how do they know that? Let me put a timeline together for you. And we're going to use this timeline quite often. Now, the first date in yellow is what? The date of authorship. When it was originally written. Do we have the original? I'll make this really clear. We do not have a single original of any ancient piece of literature that was ever written on any kind of parchment, papyrus, anything that ever existed. Now, we have stones, things like that, but literature from the late BC, early AD era, we don't have a single original of anything that was ever written, that was ever written on parchments, scrolls, leaves, animal skins. No originals exist. So we don't have whatever copy he had. That's disintegrated, lost, destroyed. Who knows? We don't have it. All we have is a copy of a copy of a copy. Now you notice in our timeline it goes from centuries BC to centuries AD all the way up until it ends at 1400 and 1500. Can anyone tell me why we've ended the timeline there? Very good. The printing press was invented in 1439, I think. 1439, they invent the printing press. So up until that date, we are concerned with manuscripts. After that, we're not concerned. Why? No more copyist errors. Once they make the plates, that is set in stone. Every copy will be identical, and they can run it off like that. Literally, Kinko's. Kinko's was invented in the 15th century. Essentially. So, when I want to understand manuscripts, there are several questions that I want to ask. Here's a picture of a manuscript of the Gospel of John. This is, to date, the oldest, mostly complete copy of the Gospel of John in existence today. This particular manuscript typically is dated around 200 AD, 170 years after the events, and probably 150 years, give or take, to 130 years after the event was recorded. As far as the estimations on when, remember, we don't have the original, so we can't look at an original and say this was written on this around this time period. All we have are these manuscripts like that. And the way they date them is by looking at the handwriting style, whether or not it used punctuation, because there was a time when these languages didn't use punctuation. If you see punctuation, it was written much later. Certain phrases and terminologies, ways of saying things. These linguist specialists will look at the way the script was written and come up with a plus or minus 50-year estimate as to when these things were written. So these dates are hotly debated, not always unanimously agreed upon, and very generalistic. But between, you know, late 2nd century to early 3rd century, they can date this manuscript too. And it's the most complete copy that we have. Now, we have older copies, but when we look at manuscripts like this, there isn't any one manuscript, like, oh, this is it. Where do we get the New Testament from? Oh, here it is. There it is. It's in a museum. You can look at it. That's not the way it works. Oftentimes, these things that were written that long ago, that were created that long ago, copies of copies, as you can see, it's pretty tattered up. It doesn't survive the test of time very well. So we rely on multiple copies to arrive at what we think the original would have been. Okay? So the question we want to ask when it comes to manuscript integrity is, how many of these manuscripts do we actually have? That's very critical. Because if I have just a handful, let's say something that was written in 50 BC, but I don't find a single copy until the 9th or 10th century, what does that tell me? I know when it was written because of who it was written by, and I know when that person lived and so on. But as far as what happened to what he actually wrote, any copyist could have made any changes, and we would have no way of knowing for that 900-year period until that first manuscript. And that's only if the manuscript is complete. If it's just part of it, I have to piece it together with another manuscript that may have the missing part in order to arrive at what I think is the complete version. And that's the case with Caesar's Gallic Wars. The first manuscript we have in existence is 950 years after the original date of writing. So if I only have one, then I can say we might have what he wrote. But I can't say we definitely have the original. The integrity would be really questionable. Unless I have lots. So we want to ask how many. Now when we compare writings of history, as you can see from the graph here, we have Aristotle. In fact, I just downloaded all the works of Aristotle. It was awesome. I thought I would read some Aristotle. It's really hard, but there's some good translations. And surprisingly, we only have around 50 manuscripts of the works of Aristotle. That's it, just 50 tattered, beat-up fragments here and there, pieces of what he wrote. And yet, when I was downloading it from these university websites, they said these are the complete works of Aristotle. And I kept thinking, how do they know? Well, they have almost 50 manuscripts. Now, as we go up, you can see we have a lot more for Plato. Now, look at Caesar, this work right here. Wow, 251. Where's the little circle? Is it going to pop up? There it is. There's Caesar's Gallic Wars. Whoa, we don't have one. We don't have two. We have 251 of these. So that increases my chances of saying, yeah, this is what he wrote. Really interesting. Really interesting. But that's based on 251 manuscripts. Now let's take a look here, see what we got next. The New Testament. We looked at the timeline when we looked at Caesar's Gallic Wars. The New Testament was written anywhere between the 40s AD to, some say the book of Revelation was written maybe around 95 AD, and that maybe even John may have even written his gospel around the same time. Good chances are, right now there's a current trend in New Testament scholarship suggesting that all the New Testament was definitely written prior to 70 AD, because not a single New Testament author makes mention of the destruction of Jerusalem except in a prophetic sense. And because of this evidence, you know, if John was writing his gospel, he would have made mention that not only did Jesus predict the temple, but that it came to pass. And so most conservative New Testament scholars are going to place the writing of the New Testament prior to 70 AD, with the exception of the book of Revelation. There's a couple little signals. There's a debate. It's a debate. When was written? Before 70 AD or after? There's a mention of a couple things that place it perhaps later, in around 95 AD. But that would be the only one in the New Testament. As far as the Gospels are concerned, all written prior to 70 AD, prior to the fall of the temple, and most likely within, some say within 5 to 7 years of the events, up till 10 or 15 years. So these things, and that's based on fragments we've discovered, but what we need to discover is how many scribal copying errors, how many manuscripts do we have? Copies, we don't have the originals. How many copies do we have until the printing press? And so that's what we're going to ask about the New Testament here. And the answer is quite traumatic, and these are changing every day. Look at the difference between what we see in other pieces of ancient literature compared to the New Testament. I was with Josh McDowell. Both Joe and I were at a private event hosted by Josh McDowell Ministries. He was there. I had as my debate partner his son, who's now a really great apologist and. But he was my debate partner when we were both going through the Campus Crusade evangelistic speaking training back in the mid-90s. In this private event, we were unmasking masks. They're discovering manuscripts every month. In fact, some of the most highly regarded New Testament scholars today who were there at the event. In fact, I got to get a book signed by the world's foremost Dead Sea Scroll scholar. He's such a nice guy from South Africa. And he's like, yeah, call me anytime you want. Love to hang out with you. I was like, sweet. I mean, this is a guy who, he's one of the few people who has an all-access pass to go look at the Dead Sea Scrolls in Israel anytime he wants. He pretty much curates the whole exhibit and all that. Anyhow, super nice guy. Great event. They showed us, in fact, we got to handle and separate and organize fragments of manuscripts. What they would do is people would make these copies over and over again. Hundreds and hundreds of copies. And people would find an error, throw it away. If a scribal, this is Jewish methodology. They don't say, and Jesus said, da da da. Jesus said, then he was going to go down to the thing. And then they all got into the boat. They don't do it that way. This is how a Jewish scribe copies something they consider Holy Scripture. A. B. B. And then they have several other scribes who are comparing. A, B, B, C, D. Oh. Throw it away. Start over. These would get accumulated in trash heaps. Someone's going to die. This is happening now in Egypt because these manuscripts were being circulated all over the known world. There is they have found fragments of the Gospel of Mark in the Dead Sea Scroll collection. Far south. Dated, way early, and somehow the Gospels were being copied and collected and even passed on as far as where the Qumran caves were. Wow, and the Gospel of Mark is supposed by scholars to be the first and earliest, and that the other Gospels may have even used references from Mark to make sure they were compiling an accurate portrayal of what took place in the other Gospels. That's supposed, but nevertheless, it shows that these things were being copied and distributed. And so here's what they were saying, is that oftentimes someone would die, and they would make a burial mask, Egyptian burial mask. And, of course, these things had to be made. So they would do is they would go to the trash heap and just take pieces of papyrus and make layers, kind of like paper mache balloon. How many of you ever done paper mache balloon? Now imagine if someone said, hey, I want you to take your paper mache balloon. I want you to strip it back apart and tell me some of the articles that were written on the newspaper. That's exactly what we were doing. They would go and dig up these burial masks, buy them from collectors, and through a very careful and tedious chemical process of washing the masks, allowing solutions to separate them, draw off the glues that they would use to make these masks, and clean the material so that you could read the writing without destroying the material or the writing that was originally on there. And sometimes they would find fragments of manuscripts that someone had written something on it and then kind of washed it and wrote something new on it. So they could find multiple layers of writings. And in that single event, we found a 4th century fragment of the book of Galatians. The guy said, don't ever write how many manuscripts we have because we discover new ones every single month. Every single month, we're finding new fragments that date back to the 2nd, 3rd, 4th century. Showing that the New Testament was heavily circulated. Now here's the cool thing. The more manuscripts you have, the easier it is to arrive at what is considered in copyist error and what is considered genuine source material. So if I have this book as my example, and I have 100 copies, I can compare them one to the other. If I see consistency with very little distortion, I can say, wow, whoever copied, and from a variety of dates and time, I can say, wow, the people who copied this cared about it enough to not make a lot of mistakes. That gives me a higher degree of reasonable certainty that what the original author wrote has been preserved with integrity to what I have, so that what I have today is genuine, is trustworthy. Now, the next question I want to ask is, I may have 100, 200, 25,000. But what happens if all 25,000 date to the 11th century? Is that going to help me? Not as much. It's helpful, but it's only a few hundred years prior to the printing press. I still don't know the grandparents of those manuscripts. What happened to the manuscripts those were copied from? And the ones those were copied from. I don't have any idea what happened to any of those manuscripts over all first 11, 10 centuries. So, the next question, the most obvious question, is how early are the manuscripts that have been found? And the earlier the better. The closer to the original date of writing, the better my manuscript is. So that one that I showed you from the second century, or from 280, that's a really good, 200 years is really fantastic. Now, when we compare various manuscripts, back to our timeline, Julius Caesar, 50 BC, going to the next one, was written. The first manuscript we have is around 900, as I said before, 950 years. We have no idea what happened. That's the earliest manuscript we have today of Caesar's Gallic Wars, dates to about 900 AD. If it was written in 50 BC, I have no idea what kind of errors were made and whether those errors were accidentally preserved in future generation copies and ended up in that copy that we have from the 9th century. No idea. So it puts a little doubt. Depends on what's worth changing. What makes, you know, the way they have to approach it now is by looking at sayings that people didn't really say during that time. Wordings they would have never used, and so it becomes a real tedious task to arrive at what is original source material and what isn't. It makes it that much harder and casts a lot of doubt on the integrity of something that has that much of a time span. We look at other things like Aristotle, written around 400. Earliest manuscript is 700, 800 years later. Virgil wrote in around the same time. And the earliest manuscript we have for that is, Aristotle is much later, 1,300 years to 1,500 years later. Earliest known manuscript for Virgil was actually relatively short. That's unusual to have something as early as the 3rd or 4th century for something that was written, you know, just prior to the 1st century. That's only 350 years or so. That's a really reasonable gap, and that'd be considered very favorable and above the norm. On average, manuscripts we have of ancient literature, on average, 900 to 1,000 year time gap between the original date of writing and the first manuscript we have in existence. That is sort of the common trend. When we compare these things to the New Testament, now, if we were to shrink down our timeline to looking at just the first and second century, this is something very important to note. Go ahead and take it to the next. What happens when legends begin? Remember, the accusation is that the Christ of faith is different from the Christ of history. The Christ of faith was invented around that time period. Those are when all the legends about Jesus begin. And that's when the invention of Jesus being divine, being God, coming down to earth, performing miracles, and even rising from the dead. That's when these stories were made up. And in fact, we have some proof that a lot of stuff was made up. Because in 1945, in Egypt, a couple of guys who were out looking for fertilizer stumbled across a clay pot and found a whole bunch of books in it. In fact, they found 54 books. If you exclude the copies, 45 works or books of writings. Included in those works of writing was the Gospel of Thomas. You guys have that in your Bible? Gospel of Thomas? You don't? Oh, I wonder why. The Gospel of the Egyptians, the Apocryphon of John, Apocryphon of James, the Apocalypse of Peter, among many others, which should pop up here in a second. The thing is that these are what scholars called pseudonymous. I think I'm saying that right. Pseudonymous, meaning pseudo, fake, and anonymous. It means it was an anonymous author who took a known name from the time of Jesus, someone who knew Jesus, a contemporary of Jesus, and stuck their name on it. I don't know if it's pseudo-anonymous or pseudonymous. It's one of those two. And they can tell this pretty clearly because when you actually read what these things say, it's very unlike what you read in the Gospels. You get all kinds of... there's a Gospel of Thomas infancy gospel as well as the Gospel of Thomas. It's the sayings of Jesus. But there's stories about him as a kid, things that he did. There's all kinds of really strange theological. Go ahead and put up the rest of that list there. There's a lot of crazy philosophies. These are what they call the Gnostic Gospels because the way they described the theology was very, very different than first century Judaism. In fact, it's nothing like first century Judaism. And that's why the consensus of scholarship is that these were pseudonymous, meaning they were fake names of contemporaries of Jesus, but these aren't people who actually wrote these things. Someone else wrote it anonymously and then tacked on Judas, Peter, Mary, people, recognizable names to give instantaneous credibility. Now, with the New Testament Gospels, this never occurred. You don't have Luke, John, Mark tagged on to the beginning of the actual letter like you see with these Gnostic Gospels. These names were attributed to these authors later on as recognized having been written by that person. But it wasn't like the author said, I am the Apostle John who knew Jesus, and I am writing this to you today. Not when it came to the eyewitness accounts. But that's different from like the case with Luke. But still, these names that were attributed to the Gospels were discovered and attributed later, whereas these Gnostic Gospels self-proclaimed their names. And these also date to around the late 2nd century. That's when they date these books, these writings, to the late 2nd century when all these legends begin. Now, the accusation is that that's when all the other Gospels and stories were made up. Except we have found manuscripts that date prior to the time period when legend begins to develop. There's a certain time period where the historians can say that when an event takes place, it takes so much time before these events can actually become legend. And here we have a manuscript of a Gospel of John called P52, and it dates about AD 125. And not only that, but not only do we have old manuscripts, but we also have quotations of the Gospels that we have in our Bible today. Now, you'll notice that I haven't picked this up yet. I have talked about God and Jesus and all that, but I haven't picked this up yet because we haven't established this as a credible record. So I don't have the actual right or credibility to even pick this up, and because this can't tell me anything about Jesus until I demonstrate this to be a genuine record of integrity concerning Jesus' life. So as I look at this and compare it to the Gnostic Gospels and so on, I have also these quotations of these early believers, people who were students of the disciples. So, for example, we have early apostolic fathers, Clement of Rome, Polycarp, Ignatius. The writings of the apostolic fathers of the late 1st and 2nd century quoted extensively from New Testament books. They never quoted from these Gnostic Gospels, the Gospel of Thomas. By the way, let me just show you, I'm going to read you something from the Gospel of Thomas. One of the sayings of Jesus. Now, this is interesting. This is one good reason for why we don't attribute this to actually Jesus or anybody who was his contemporary because of the content. Simon Peter said to them, "Let Mary leave us, for women are not worthy of life." Jesus said, "I myself shall lead her in order to make her male, so that she too may become a living spirit resembling you males. For every woman who will make herself male will enter the kingdom of heaven." That's the Gospel of Thomas. Yeah. Now, if there was anyone who revolutionized the concept of equality, not revolutionized, but was a champion of equality, biblical equality, it was Jesus. I mean, and his disciples. I mean, what did Paul say? There is neither male nor female, slave or free. We are all one. This concept was foreign to first century Roman and Jewish culture. Gosh, women were just, it was different. And it's not really any different than it is today. We have to have social, cultural, moral changes to constantly remind us of these things. Otherwise, we'll revert back to taking advantage of one another, whether it be men over women or whatever it may be, men over men. Human beings have throughout time always found ways of taking advantage of each other. And Jesus came along and said, that ain't right. You know, when Mary was sitting at his feet, not his mother, but the other Mary was sitting at his feet listening to him. This was never the place for a woman. A woman was never to sit at the feet of a rabbi, a teacher, and be instructed. And yet here he was teaching and there she was sitting. And of course, Martha was like, hey, gosh, you know, your job is housework. You should be in the kitchen with me. I'm slaving over here. And what did Jesus do? Did he say, yeah, she's right. Women belong over there. In fact, for every woman who will make herself male will enter the kingdom of heaven. So, no, he didn't say that. He said, no, she's found the good thing. She's done the right thing. And he actually endorsed her taking an exclusively male position of learning under a lecturer. It'd be like if we didn't allow women to go to college And all of a sudden, Jesus is a professor at, you know, God University. And all of a sudden, a woman walks in and sits in the front row. All the men are like, since when did women allow to go to college? And Jesus goes, hey, no, this is right. You know, that'd be weird to see that situation, but that's exactly what Jesus did. And let's go back to our, okay. So when we look at these early church fathers, they wrote extensively, and we have what they wrote. And they quoted the New Testament extensively. In fact, look at the first one. Polycarp, writing from about 110 AD, long before legend stories appear of Jesus' life. And he quotes or refers to 18 New Testament books, including all four Gospels. Next, writing in around 108, Ignatius, Bishop of Antioch, quotes and refers to 24 New Testament books, including all four Gospels. And finally, stepping into the first century, Clement, Bishop of Rome, quotes, refers to the existence of 11 New Testament books, including Matthew, Mark, and Luke. Now, doesn't mean that John wasn't written. He just didn't quote from it in anything that we have in existence today. But what this shows is that they recognize the genuine letters and writings and records of first century Jesus, quoted from them, recognized them. That means that these things were all in circulation. If we eliminate every manuscript we have, it shows that what was written was in circulation by the end of the first century, 100 years to 80, 70 years prior to all these legends and Gnostic Gospels that we have in appearance. Now, there was discovered several fragments, and we, like I said, we keep finding new manuscripts every month. So sometimes most of the time they date late, but every now and then we find something that dates much earlier, or something we've had in our possession at a museum or in someone's collection, and they didn't know what it was. And all of a sudden a collector or a scholar goes and looks at it and says, do you know what you have there? I don't know. I just thought it was some Greek thing. I can read that ancient Greek, and that's actually a gospel. Oh, I didn't know that. Yeah, a glossary look at the script, that's probably first century maybe. So they have it analyzed, scholars look at it, they compare the writing style, the phraseology, et cetera, and then they date it. And these manuscripts get discovered in various ways, and we have found fragments from Matthew, Mark, Luke that some scholars are now dating down to the first century. Even better is this fragment here. This is part of Matthew 26, dated by Dr. Karsten Peter Thied, and he dated it at 66 A.D., and that's a fragment. Not a whole copy, but a fragment. Go ahead and go to the next one there. Yeah, I already did that one. Skip. There you go. This is a fragment, not a whole gospel, but based on what little writing, it's on front and back. Christians were the first ones to invent books, apparently. You know, the Jewish did things with scrolls. But when we start looking at these gospels, we start to see writing on both sides and in page form with binding. And not in scroll form. So it was really fascinating, the revolution in writing technology as it developed in the first century. But 66 AD, that's within one eyewitness generation. Now, why is that relevant? Let's say I became a real popular speaker, because I'm not a real popular speaker now, 50 years from now, if I was even alive then. But let's say I'm just, you know, this older fella running around the country talking about 9/11. Yep, I was there. That damn near 9/11. Aliens came out of the sky and blew up two towers. And let's say for some reason we had a big World War III and we eliminated every videotape and newspaper article that was ever produced, any photographs on 9/11. Say someone was the son of Vendetta to destroy that ever happened, and they managed to destroy every YouTube video, every copy, and every picture ever existed about that. Could I, in even 20 years from now, go around the country and teach college students that 9/11 was the result of an alien attack and a conspiratorial cover-up by the government saying it was terrorists? Are you sure? No video. I can't, like, show them a video. people were still alive. Anyone who was there could simply stand up and say, you know, I've been hearing you go around saying all this. You are a liar. I was there. I saw the airplane, not UFO, not lasers. I would not get away with it. The stories about Jesus performing miracles and coming back from the dead were clearly circulated within the first eyewitness generation. And right now, this was in a culture that was not pro-Christianity. Shut it down. Stop it. Put them out. Kill them. Slay them. When did Christianity become popular? And when was that? Fourth century. Hundreds of years later, when Christians were being dragged into the Colosseums and being eaten by lions, it wasn't until hundreds of years later where they were now allowed to sit in the seats as free people. Way past the Gnostic Gospels, all the legendary writing periods. So if there was legends to be had, they would have been had. If there was any writing, historian of the first century, who wrote a contrary apologetic, a rebuttal to the Christian faith, surely that would have been something that would have been preserved. I mean, the Gnostic Gospels were preserved. Nobody recognized those as authoritative. Even when Christianity became the religion of Rome, nobody bothered to take all those things and get rid of them or destroy them. Those things existed. They were allowed to exist. People appreciated history. We don't see anything written in the first century as a rebuttal to the resurrection, the claims of Jesus. No one came out and said, his body is on 1233 Jerusalem Street. Just go over there. So we took it out because we didn't want you guys to steal it and make it big hoo-ha-ha. We have the body. Nothing comes up. What we do have in circulation are these gospel eyewitness accounts in circulation within 20 years. So if we go back to our timeline, we have Jesus' resurrection, supposed around 30 AD. The eyewitness time period. It is reported that some of the disciples lived till around 95 to 100 AD. So that's the eyewitness time period. We have the earliest gospel manuscripts that we have in our hands around 60 to 70 AD, placing the original writings within 20 years or so of the original date of writing, 40 years around, give or take, from the original event. And then quotations of New Testament early church fathers, quotations of the New Testament around 100 AD, all 60 to 100 years prior to Legends of Jesus' beginning. Oh, and don't forget the John Ryland's fragment dated to 120 AD. So is it safe to say that what I'm reading here at Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John is just as the same amount of credibility as the Gospel of Thomas, the Gospel of Mary, and so on and so forth, that were all dated to the late second century? Not even close. Not even close. There is no way that legend could have been introduced to the text that quick without major rebuttals from eyewitnesses. There were too many people. Even Paul used it as an argument. He quotes in 1 Corinthians 15 a common saying. It's clear that it came something from the earliest sayings of Jesus. You know, the part about then the 12 and then Mary and then 500, et cetera, et cetera. Well, he points out in that very letter, you yourselves go and talk to the people who were there. He was, may not have been there, even though he was an eyewitness of Jesus himself, the resurrected Jesus, but he says, you can go talk to them. If you don't believe what I'm saying, go and ask them. They were there. Go ask the soldiers. Go ask anybody who was around at the time and ask them what happened. Maybe they didn't see Jesus rise from the dead, but they didn't find the body. And the disciples are running around preaching that he was come back from the dead. So when we look at this, we have the New Testament fragments, and we look at it at the big scheme of history, because we have so many manuscripts, get this, we have manuscripts that date to every century in history prior to the printing press. Those 24,000 manuscripts, we have over nearly 6,000 in the original language, you know, like 9,000 in several different languages throughout the time of it being not only copied but translated. And we have them dating to every century in history. So that means if someone says, look, like the Muslims claim, this has been changed. The Jesus you believe is not the Jesus of the first century, but a made-up Jesus that was changed hundreds of years later. The manuscript evidence says otherwise. Because I can take Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John and compare every manuscript to itself and to the rest and throughout time and say, wow, I can take and compare second century manuscripts with third century and so on and so forth. And I can see, this one doesn't have that. This one says it differently. And you know what? We don't hide it. You can open up any modern study Bible and it'll tell you exactly every little copyist error that we've found. Again, no book in history has been more scrutinized and more challenged than the Bible. And yet, you can go through and it'll say, some manuscripts do not contain this word. Of the 25,000 lines of the New Testament, only 40 are in question. And of those 40, they have no bearing on any major theological or doctrinal issue. Sometimes translators just don't know what the word means exactly. They're like, I can't find the use of that word anywhere else in the ancient world. Your guess is as good as mine. They do the best they can. Like, for example, when Paul talks about marriage in 1 Corinthians 7, some translations will say his daughter, and some translations will say his virgin, and they're not quite sure. You have situations like that, but they're so few and far between. And based on biblical interpretive methods like hermeneutics, we always have scripture to interpret scripture. So whenever we come across those vague translations, that's why whenever you're doing real good study of the Bible, you want to compare translations. You want to see what the commentators have because they'll actually have an understanding of the language, the grammar, the historical context. Bring all this stuff in. The bulk of what we believe as evangelical, born-again Christians is spot on to what the New Testament and the Old Testament teach. Now, again, here's just a graph just to kind of give you a picture of the time span between the oldest manuscript and the original date of writing. There's nothing like the New Testament. The manuscript evidence is overwhelming. Skipping on down, there's a couple quotes from some scholars, all you can get in the book. Skip that because we're pretty much out of time. How accurate have the manuscripts that have been found? Let's just take you to the graph real quick. When we compare, and I just kind of talked about it, but I'll just show you the graph. When we compare the evidence, comparing to other pieces of ancient literature, and remember, when we as Christians say that the Bible is inerrant, I may have sounded just now like I said, well, there's mistakes and errors. Don't misunderstand me. When we say that there are variants, that's not to say that there's an error. The doctrine of inerrancy, which I'm not going to address today, perhaps we can address it when we talk about Mormonism and Jehovah's Witness, because they accuse the Bible of having been changed, just like Muslims do. We have plenty of opportunities to address this, but when we say that the Bible is inerrant and inspired by God, that is not to say that every copy that has ever existed is perfect. When we say that it is inerrant, it simply means that there are no theological fundamental errors in the original autographs, which we do not have. But that's not to say that there aren't manuscript variants, meaning a couple of good examples are the end of Mark. A lot of the oldest manuscripts don't contain it. When I'm dialoguing with a Muslim, I will make sure that I have a Bible that does not include that passage in the main text. It could be a footnote. Same with the story of Jesus being confronted by the Pharisees with the woman caught in adultery. Some of the very, very oldest, like that one I showed you, does not contain that story. It's found in manuscripts that date much, much later. But here's the reason why it's in most Bibles. It's because it's in the majority of the manuscripts. But the majority of the manuscripts are later. The further we go in time, the bulkier the manuscripts get, the more we have. The earlier we go back, the lighter the amount that we have. But we still have those old ones that we can compare. And again, these don't have any bearing on any. Some people will say, you know what, this particular manuscript, it may have been that first, even though that's the oldest one, perhaps the story was original, but was just excluded in that one manuscript. And these other manuscripts that are later were copied from better accurate manuscripts. And we lost the copies, but we have the later results. And so there's a big debate, but it's not a big dividing debate. Some say I go with the majority. Other scholars will say I want to go with the oldest. If it's older, it's more accurate, period. Which way you go is really irrelevant, because we're only talking about a handful of verses that aren't included in these older manuscripts. And the stories, again, don't have any real bearing on changing who Jesus is. And so we're pretty good with that. Now, I wish I could take more time, but I want to just bring up this graph. And you can see that when we compare these manuscripts, when we talk about these particular verses, we're talking less than a percent. In fact, the New Testament is 99.8% exactly what was originally written. That's the consensus of scholarship today, is that what they wrote has been preserved. When we compare that to things like Homer's Iliad, which we have more manuscripts for that than anything else other than the New Testament. It's like 1,100, 1,200 for Homer's Iliad. But yet, when we compare the manuscripts, we see a nearly 5% distortion. That means that there was a lot of loose and fast copying with negligence. When we compare one of the most ancient religious texts, the Mahabharata, when we compare manuscripts, the distortion rate is 10%, over 10% change. There's no way you can have confidence in what was originally written when all your manuscripts are showing that many variants. When you compare that to the New Testament, there literally is nothing like it in existence. It is truly even if you discount the stories in it as fiction, it is one of the marvels of ancient literature. It really is. The question, though, is it historical? Well, without going into any detail, if you want to check out the book table or ask Pastor Bo or Scott, we can recommend several resources. A couple of good ones I'd recommend, a couple books I'd recommend is Cold Case Christianity. We had a pleasure of meeting J. Warner Wallace. He was called the Evidence Whisperer. He was a cold case detective for 20 years, an L.A. cop. And he was a skeptic, an atheist, believed that religion was a mental crutch for weak-minded people until he started looking at the evidence. He applied his cold case murder-solving skills to the Gospels and came out a believer. He does this with the two books. One is on the historicity of Jesus. And this one is God's Crime Scene, God's Fingerprints on the Universe and Why We Should Believe in God. Another helpful resource that I would recommend to anybody who wants to be a contender for the faith. As we go through this next year, I highly recommend this book. It's probably one of the best books that I have on my shelf on just answering the skeptics. Called On Guard by William Lane Craig. His other book's a little more heady, a little more philosophical. It's actually almost like a textbook, but one of the first books I ever read in my early 20s. I think I just picked this one up. This is the third edition. I have the first edition. But this is also a really great book if you want to graduate onto a more graduate level type thing. Sorry? Right, Reasonable Faith. Yeah, Reasonable Faith. Probably two of the best books you can own. And just general apologetics. Now, when it comes to the New Testament, its historicity, Luke, as an author, he mentions cities and places and names. In fact, the New Testament does this often. Whenever you start naming cities, places, people, you run the risk of getting caught for lying. And just take a shovel, go out to Israel, start digging, and you will find evidence supporting just about anything that people were skeptical about. There's been time and time again where people would say things like, Jesus couldn't have been crucified. There were no nails. Well, I have pictures of a crucified victim from dated to 42 AD. And the nail, actually, if you can bring it up real quick, we'll just skip all the the fluff, goes straight to the picture of the nail. People didn't believe that Pontius Pilate was a real person. They weren't sure that Pontius Pilate was a real person. Oh, they found a stone that was an archway to a city that dedicated a temple to Tiberius Caesar, and it says Pontius Pilate right on the stone. And just go ahead and click to the pictures of the archaeological stuff. You can see Luke mentions names, places. We don't know if these people were real, and if they are, we don't have them written anywhere else. So how do we know that Luke was telling the truth? How do we know that his writing was historical, or any of the gospel writers for that matter? Again, this keeps going. I'll just show you these two really cool images, and then we're going to go straight down to the very end. Go to the one where it shows, like, the bone box, if you can. Yeah, and then skip forward. Yeah, so that's a picture I took when I went to the Israeli Museum. And it says Joseph Caiaphas on the bone box. We found his gravestone. I mean, bone boxes were unique to the first century. When a person would die, they would bury them. And, yep, there was me in front of the bone box. They would bury the person until for so many days and weeks and months, until they would be decomposed enough where they would just basically fold them up, compile the bones, and put the bones into a box. And that would be their permanent burial place. So Jesus obviously never underwent this next step. He was wrapped in the preservation process to allow his body to decompose. Months later, maybe even years later, his body would have been folded up and put in a box had he been around that long, had his body been dead that long. But obviously it wasn't. Same here, we found a bone box. This is a little controversial, but there was a bone box dating to the first century that says James, son of Joseph, brother of Jesus. If you take those three facts and say, what are the odds of there being a person in Jerusalem actually named James, who was a son of Joseph, and who had a brother named Jesus, the probability rate is very, very low. It's like, this is a really good chance. People are still debating whether the inscription is authentic. Some people have accused the collector of forgery. He has come out clean as a whistle after a 7-year trial. And no one has actually provided any strong controversial evidence suggesting that this inscription was, maybe it said James at one point because the patina is there. They can look at the length. Many polygraphers have looked at it and said, yes, this is clearly first century. The inscription is genuine. Others disagree. The ones who disagree already had a bias. They already published publicly sayings that they knew that it was a forgery before even examining it. And so now these guys are coming out and saying it was a forgery. I don't know. It remains to be seen. But it's one of those other things that could be a very positive evidence. In fact, the first piece of evidence, physical evidence, of Jesus existing in the first century that comes from something other than a manuscript fragment or something. Going on to the crucifixion victim very quickly. Go ahead and skip this part. These are just several individuals who were places and peoples that I visited in Israel that were mentioned in the Bible and that archaeology has proved to be true. Again, you know, so much of the Old Testament, many of the places and peoples and situations, senses, things that it took place that people just said, what is he talking about? This, we don't have any evidence in history. Time and time and time again, the evidence proves the otherwise. So the discovery was made in 1968. This was really cool. I took a lot of pictures of this. Go ahead and go to the next slide there. This is a picture of a guy's ankle. That's his ankle bone. And you can see what happened to the nail. If you go to the next picture, the nail hit a knot in the when he was crucified, and it got bent and stuck in the wood. So rather than trying to, they couldn't pull the nail out. They just threw the whole nail in the wood. Obviously, the wood decomposed and disintegrated. But they just chopped up the cross that he was hung on and threw it all together in the bone box. We found it, and they dated it to 42 AD. For a while, there were some radical professors saying the Bible had to have been made up, because nails did not exist during the time of Jesus. Nails were used much later. Whoever wrote this stuff lived much later when they were using nails and never thought to ask, were they using nails during the time of Jesus? They got it wrong. And yet, archaeology has once again proved they did use them. And Again, you can find evidence for this for the Old Testament, the New Testament, places, cities, unbelievable. There are volumes. In fact, there's an NIV translation of the Bible called the NIV Archaeology Study Bible. It is replete with amazing little discoveries that have proved places, cities, facts about the historicity of the New Testament. So that's discovery number 5 or 4, whichever one we're on. Go to the end with the tomb, the empty tomb. I just want to show you 4 facts that is the consensus of modern day scholarship. And what I leave with you is my final proof. If you can find it, it's towards the very bottom. Not the very bottom of the slide presentation because I hid most of them. In fact, I'll tell you which slide number it is. Let's see here. There we go. 155. Yeah, we're doing our next tour. We're doing a Faith Search Israel tour, and it's not just a let's go see the sites. We actually follow the Gospel of Mark piece by piece and go to every in fact, our tour guide and the tour director both said they had done hundreds and hundreds of these, and they said, we've never been on a tour this unique. And this is fascinating from a historical perspective, simply because we followed the Bible, the Gospel of Mark, piece by piece, to demonstrate the peoples, the places, and we went and visited these spots where these events took place. We went and visited Peter's house. And we're not just saying these are what Christians say is Peter's house. We only went to the scholarly sites. If it was a popularized site that was popularized by Christians hundreds and hundreds of years later, we kind of downplayed those sites. We went to the sites where archaeologists would say, no, this is Peter's house. We have good evidence that believe that the Peter who knew Jesus lived right here, and this was the synagogue that Jesus often taught about, that, of course, the church was built on top of, but now that the church was torn down, and now that we've excavated, we see this was actually a synagogue at one time, and this is Peter's house, and here's the shore, here are the docks, here's the kind of boat that Jesus would have been in, here's why Jesus was sleeping during the storm, and why he didn't wake up until they went and woke him up. Unbelievable. I mean, it brings to life what we read, and when people say these are just a bunch of made-up stories, they really have no idea what they're talking about. It's just rhetoric and has no basis in reality whatsoever. 4 facts that, in general, the consensus of modern scholarship agrees on. That Jesus was a real person in history. He claimed to be God, and he was crucified under Pontius Pilate for it. Fact number 1, Jesus was honorably buried, and the tomb was empty. Very few historians dispute that fact. There was a man named Jesus. Whether they consider him a revolutionary, whether they believe in the miracles or not is irrelevant. Most of them don't. Most of them don't believe in the miracles. Most of them believe that Jesus was a revolutionary and his body most likely rotted in a field somewhere. But here's what they agree. The historical evidence points that there was a man named Jesus executed, crucified, and that his body went missing, the empty tomb. Fact number 2. Eyewitnesses place him alive and having appeared to them. That's not a disputed fact of history. There were eyewitnesses. Some people try to explain away by saying Jesus never died. He resuscitated and he just walked out of the tomb. Some people will say that someone else died in his place. And so when Jesus appeared, obviously eyewitnesses thought he came back from the dead. We can definitely deal with those facts when we talk about Islam and other some of these others. When we get to that, because that's one of the arguments Islam has, and that the lives were transformed, the disciples were transformed, they gave their lives for believing that Jesus had come back from the dead. That's not just a disputed fact, and that the spread of Christianity is the result of the empty tomb, of these other facts. These are undisputed facts. And the question I ask people whenever I'm sharing this information is, what is the most reasonable explanation? I don't have to prove anything. But what is the most reasonable explanation? When people talk to me about being a skeptic or saying, I don't believe any of that, so I would say, what would it take to prove to you that it would be true? What if I showed you that there was eyewitness accounts that placed in any court of law, if we were to try a person for murder like J. Warner Wallace used to do as a cold case detective, they'd find these people 20, 30, 40 years after the fact. They'd find evidence and they'd catch their killer and they would convict him, even if he was in his old age. It's happened many times. And you would think, what in the world could they possibly produce to convict a person of a crime they couldn't convict them of at the time? There aren't any eyewitnesses now. You know, there's how do you go about that process? And he takes that same approach, applies it to the Bible, and shows that it is extremely, almost beyond reasonable doubt, that Jesus was who he claimed to be, and that our faith is reasonable. It's not a blind leap in the dark. Faith isn't believing in what you know isn't true. In fact, the biblical definition of faith is very different than the cults. The cults tell you, just believe, don't question. That's what they tell Mormons. Did you have an experience, an emotional, warm, fuzzy feeling? Great, that's private, personal, that's for you. No, Christianity says, no, if you don't believe me, go test it. In fact, Paul said, don't believe anything we say until you first test it to see if it is true. He considered this, what is the group? Bereans. The Bereans as more noble for having checked out what he was teaching from Scripture. He considered that he didn't, like the cults tell you, oh, well, you're questioning faith. That's not faith building. You're promoting doubt. No. Don't believe me. Go ask the eyewitnesses. Go check it out. The biblical definition of faith is trusting and established truth. Three essential elements that differentiates faith as we understand it according to the, in contrast to the caricatures and stereotypes and false understandings of faith that we hear in culture and in the cults. Knowledge, belief, and will, all equaling trust. Trusting established. First, I have to have knowledge. I have to intellectually believe that it's true, that it's objectively true. And, of course, by and large, when you present the evidence, the issue usually isn't up here. I find most often than not that the problem is right here. And I don't mean the organ, I mean the will. The person simply isn't willing to believe, regardless of the evidence. And that is the definition of faith. Are you willing to believe the truth? And a lot of times people just aren't willing, no matter the evidence, and they'll come up with every single way to argue their way around it. So I hope that's been helpful. I hope you got a lot out of today. Sorry we had to kind of rush at the end there. I don't know how we both got our hours mixed up. It was quite funny. I do apologize having had to skip some really cool stuff, but I the stuff I was going to cover is more of the sayings of Jesus, how he claimed to be God, and how he proved it with the miracles as a magician. I was going to do a little bit about that. But I went ahead and skipped right to the direct evidence, the historicity of the Gospels and his resurrection, proving what he said. Obviously, you can just open up your Bible and read what Jesus said, and you can see that the kind of miracles Jesus performed aren't the kinds of things that magicians do today. Jesus couldn't have been faking his friends, and nor would he have died for it had he been tricking people. He would have said, nope, I was kidding. Don't kill me. Joke. Ha-ha, I'm going to go on my way now and go back to being a carpenter. He didn't do that. He gave his life. His disciples gave their lives for what they believed. We have the manuscript evidence. We have the archaeological evidence. We have the evidence of intelligent designer in the universe. The evidence is there. You know, as Rabbi Zacharias once said, quoting another person or proverb, he said, God is like the sun. We can't look at it directly, but without it, we can't look at anything. And God has given us enough evidence where we can make faith a most reasonable thing, but he left enough out so that we cannot arrive or approach him by sheer reason alone. And I hope that makes sense. Remember, the definition of biblical faith is the evidence of things hoped for and the certainty of things unseen. Not an emotion, not a blind leap in the dark, but actual reasoned and evidence. Come, let us reason, as the Lord says in Isaiah. So I hope this has been good. If you have any questions, I'll just hang out rather than making this sort of a public question and answers ending time. But if you have anything you want to ask, I'll just hang out for as long as you guys are willing to ask.